She wants to get reelected. She's afraid to confront the military that basically handles national security issues.
Former Governor Bill Richardson talks with VOA about Myanmar. It's Monday, January 29th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us too on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, the U.S. Defense Secretary wraps up his visit to Southeast Asia, visiting a Mumbai slum. Juilliard contemplates Chinese music. It's all on today's VOA Asia. U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson resigned last week from an international board that advises Myanmar on the Rohingya crisis, charging the panel was not committed to change in the Southeast Asian country. Richardson, a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and energy secretary in the Bill Clinton administration, quit in the midst of the board's first visit to Western Rakhine State, where nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled a military crackdown on insurgents. Richardson said Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi was deficient in moral leadership, an accusation that came 2 days after a meeting with her and other board members. VOA's Cindy Sain spoke via Skype with the former New Mexico governor about his opinion of the board and what is happening in Myanmar right now.
I resigned. They're claiming that I was fired, but they were begging me to stay till the very last minute by the National Security Advisor. I resigned for two reasons. One, because I felt the advisory board was just a whitewashing operation meant to validate the policies of the government of Myanmar. The second reason is an explosive reaction Aung San Suu Kyi had as I was trying to give her frank advice to deal fairly with the two Reuters journalists that had been in prison. That showed me that she wasn't interested in frank advice. And this is after 30 years of a very strong friendship where we've worked together for democracy. That has obviously been shattered by my resignation.
Right, right. And I, you know, it's well documented that you've been a very good friend of Myanmar's civilian leader, Aung Suu Kyi, for many, many years. And she asked you to join the council. Was she herself, I know that the two Reuters journalists were an issue, was she herself also disparaging the United Nations journalists and relief workers trying to get the facts and alleviate suffering in the area?
Yes, certainly her chairman was, but she also, in various conversations, has disparaged the UN, felt the UN was unfair to her, the human rights investigation especially, disparaging the international media, disparaging human rights group, saying that they're all against her. These are the people that worked with her in that transition to democracy, that were her supporters, were in essence given her the Nobel Prize. She's now feels an us against one situation, an us against them situation, and has a siege mentality right now. She's changed.
Right. I was going to ask if you were sort of blindsided and really surprised by this. And do you think that she's changed now that she's in a position of power, or does she have a blind spot when it comes to the Rohingyas?
No, I think she's changed as she's assumed power. She wants to get reelected. She's afraid to confront the military that basically handles national security issues, like treatment of refugees, like I think they've been responsible for the atrocities. They have participated in the mass graves issue, finding ways, instead of helping the refugees move back to Myanmar, making it more difficult, not guaranteeing safety. And I think she's been afraid to confront them. There is a separation of power between the military and the civilian government that she heads, but she's failed to exercise moral leadership to push and tell the military that they can't keep doing this. She doesn't have control over them, but the fact that she not only doesn't speak out, but defends them is what has made her change, and I think has caused a lot of these problems that Myanmar has with the international community.
U.S. diplomat Bill Richardson speaking exclusively via Skype with VOA's Cindy Sain. These are among some of the top Asia stories that are trending on voanews.com. Afghanistan observes National Day of Mourning as death toll rises. Seven survivors of missing ferry found adrift in the Pacific. Tokyo's coin check to return $425 million in virtual money lost to hackers. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has praised the talks between North and South Korea, but says they do not address the overarching issue in the standoff over Pyongyang's nuclear and ballistic missile programs. We hear more from VOA's Bill Gallo, who is traveling with the secretary now in Hawaii.
A unified front against North Korea, as the defense chiefs of South Korea and the U.S. met at Pacific Command headquarters.
Our combined militaries stand shoulder to shoulder, ready to defend against any attack on the ROK or USA.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, once again, speaking of military options against North Korea.
Our response to this threat remains diplomacy-led, backed up with military options available to ensure that our diplomats are understood to be speaking from a position of strength.
The talks come as North and South Korea engage in negotiations about next month's Winter Olympics in South Korea. North Korea has agreed to send a delegation to the Games. Mattis praised the talks, but expressed caution about what they can achieve.
The Olympics talks alone do not address overarching problems.
South Korea's defense minister stressed his country is ultimately trying to draw out North Korea to a dialogue with the U.S. North Korea in September conducted its sixth and largest nuclear test. Its ballistic missile program is also advancing. South Korea's foreign minister this week said military options are unacceptable and that the situation should be solved by diplomacy.
The problem is war by inadvertence or by accident. When you have a highly pressurized situation, anything can happen. I think there's still room for diplomacy.
Mattis was asked during the trip whether he thinks the threat of a U.S. attack will eventually persuade North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to back down. He said he has, quote, modest expectations of his ability to predict Kim's behavior. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii.
We're glad you're starting out your week with us on VOA Asia. If you're planning a visit to India, why not make sure Mumbai's largest slum is on your places to visit? The slum packs some 1 million people into about 2 square kilometers, and it has emerged as an unlikely stop for foreign tourists. The draw is not images of squalor and poverty in the heart of India's largest city. It is, as Anjana Pasricha tells us, a place where thriving entrepreneurship and stories of hope and success break many stereotypes of a slum.
In his cramped workshop in Mumbai's Dharavi slum district, Mohammad Sheikh sifts through thousands of plastic cups that will be turned into pellets for reuse. Since coming from a village 10 years ago, the small recycling business he has built in the slum's dingy alleys enables him to give a decent education to his children.
It's all good here. I have no problems. I manage my expenses very well.
Thousands of ramshackle workshops have mushroomed haphazardly in Dharavi, as residents and an endless stream of migrants turned their hand to whatever they could, recycling the city's waste, making leather goods or garments. Today, these micro-businesses produce goods worth $1 billion and have scripted many success stories. Like that of Sohail Akhtar, who employs 6 workers in his tiny garment unit. 25 years ago, he was a worker himself. Residents like him are resisting efforts to redevelop the slum, a prime slice of land in the city's heart, where the government has offered to rehouse residents in modern buildings.
If facilities improve, our costs will increase. We work on very tiny budgets, and it will become difficult for us to survive.
Inside these narrow alleys, tourists get a perspective on why residents don't want to move out of Dharavi. No one explains it better than tour guide Ankit Gajakosh, who has co-founded Mumblu Tours. Having grown up in the area, he knows firsthand how this slum can be a driving force to improve one's life.
People are not begging. People are not into crime. People are not addicted to drugs over here. Why? Because there is so much of jobs to do. People, if they want to work, they can work and earn money. And that's how the entire environment in this place is different, quite different.
That is what tourists like Beata Pick and Panlop Thantiam discover beneath Dharavi's ramshackle veneer. Energy and entrepreneurship.
It's really, really tough, but also really surprising, and it's a real eye-opener, I would say. For a person like me, it was great to know that, you know, you can actually have a happy life in a really different condition.
I saw it, it's like us, but it's a different in the country and occupation. I do my job to get money. They do their job to get money and live their life. That's all. It's quite similar.
Dharavi may be counted among Asia's largest slums, but it is also a symbol of hope and opportunity for the underprivileged. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Mumbai.
You're listening to VOA Asia. This news alert from VOA Asia, a French woman who has been found alive on the treacherous northern Himalayan peak known as Killer Mountain, but her Polish climbing companion remains missing. An elite Polish climbing team attempting the first winter ascent of nearby K2 Mountain dropped their efforts to rescue the two stranded climbers. You'll reach the summit of great stories and features by visiting VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Without the use of traditional instruments in an interconnected world, what makes a Chinese composition distinctly Chinese? The Juilliard School's Focus Festival 2018 is seeking to challenge our preconceptions. It's led by a cast of contemporary Chinese composers and acclaimed Juilliard orchestral students. VOA's Ramon Taylor sat down with one of China's most prominent young conductors and the festival's founding director on the evolving commonalities and differences of orchestral music East and West.
What do the two largest economies in the world share in common? For one, a fervent passion for orchestra music. At the Juilliard School's 2018 Focus Festival in New York, China Today, there are few traditional Chinese instruments on stage, but that doesn't make the performances, assembled by Chinese composers, any less Chinese.
Most of this event was featured through Western orchestra. However, you can find many Chinese musical elements in most of the melodies, harmonies, and other musical imagery throughout the whole performance.
Joel Sachs, director of the festival and professor of music history, notes that one popular phenomenon among the festival's composers, and in Chinese music more broadly, is the use of nature images as a starting point for their compositions. But the difficulty in identifying the origin of a piece, he says, is not limited to our modern era cultural and economic globalization.
I think if one knew a lot about the music of the late 18th century and you listened to certain works by Mozart and not know who it was, you'd think it's an Italian composer. And I'm not just talking about opera, but his whole style. And yet, on other occasions, if you look at Mozart, you're sure he speaks German. Now, these days, it's really hard to tell, and sometimes it's because of our ignorance.
Chen Ling, one of China's most prominent young conductors and professor at the world-acclaimed Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing, conducted three works by influential contemporary Chinese composers Chen Qiyong, Guo Wenqing, and the late Qiu Qianer. The opening number can be roughly translated as chaotic picking, one that requires an infectious energy on stage.
The performance by Luan Tan by Chen Qigong requires the performers as well as the conductor to accumulate a lot of energy towards the later part of presentation and reach an explosive crescendo towards the end.
Now in its 34th year, the Focus Festival for Sachs continues to be a process of discovery.
It's the pleasure of seeing people suddenly realize that there's more music than they ever imagined existed in the world, and that it's kind of endless, and that if you're willing to explore, you never get bored.
Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can find us on iTunes and SoundCloud and download us as a podcast. Take VOA Asia wherever you happen to go during your day. One of the best ways to listen to VOA Asia, of course, is on the radio. If you happen to be in Tainan, Taiwan, catch us on the voice of Chengrung Star Radio FM 88.3 at Chengrung Christian University. That's in Tainan, Taiwan. We thank you for listening wherever you happen to be. And we thank our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, for helping bring this program to you, along with managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.